Hey folks, is your dog a picky eater? That can be really stressful. You've tried mixing things in the food, you've tried different brands, you've even sat next to them and tried to make them feel calm as they're eating. You tell yourself, they'll eat when they're hungry, right? Or maybe, just maybe, your dog knows the difference between processed brown pellets, ugh, and real food. Sundays for Dogs is different. Founded by Dr. Tori Waxman, Sundays was created to make her high standards as a veterinarian and as a dog parent, or to meet them rather. Sundays starts with 80% plus all natural meats and then adds superfoods such as kale, ginger, and blueberries. No fillers, no nutritional benefits, no chemicals, just simple, complete nutrition. And I gotta say, I have cats now, but I grew up only with dogs, and I'm reading these ingredients, and Sam can speak more to how great this dog food is, but that's all stuff I remember from growing up, like how to make your dog's coat better, how to make their digestion better, blueberries, kale, ginger. That's the real stuff here, folks. Sundays is gently air dried, instead of using high heat, so it doesn't look or smell like dog food. It looks like high quality human grade jerky. And the best part, Sundays requires no fridge, no freezer, no prep, and no mess. You get the quality of a home cooked meal with the scoop and serve ease of kibble. It's what dog food should have been all along. And Sundays just launched a brand new fish recipe. It's made with 80% whole and minced fish, including eco-friendly, invasive carp sourced from American rivers for a naturally rich flavor. In fact, did you know that many dogs naturally prefer fish flavors? So Sundays' fish recipe is especially great for your picky eaters, canine friends. Plus, it's packed with omega-3 fatty acids that help support healthy skin, shiny coats, joints, and brain function. It's complete and balanced nutrition for all life stages. It really is phenomenal, and these are the kinds of ingredients that you can get for your dog to make sure that they're as healthy as possible. Make the switch to Sundays. Go right now to sundaysfordogs.com/majority and get 50% off your first order. Or you can use code MAJORITY at checkout. That's 50% off your first order at sundaysfordogs.com/majority. sundaysfordogs.com/majority, or use code MAJORITY at checkout. And now, time for the show.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, July 13th, 2026. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Cedar, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Caitlin Voges, senior advisor to the Freedom of the Press Foundation, which partnered with The Intercept to publish her piece, Online Age Verification Law Could Kill Whistleblowing. And later in the show, Alex Aronson, co-founder and executive director of Court Accountability, joins Sam for a conversation about the Supreme Court's endless corruption. Also on the program, well, we were on dead Republican senator watch. The gods threw us a curveball. In what has been a bad week to be named Graham, bloodthirsty ghoul Senator Lindsey Graham died suddenly at the age of 71, and we are partying.
He will be missed.
Are you lying?
Because Sam's not here to raid on the parade. Every time somebody dies, he's always like, I just regret that they were never held accountable for their actions.
Oh, yeah. And, no, we can party. I mean, he died pretty young, which is awesome. Speaking of Sam, no one's accounted for his whereabouts, have they?
Nope.
He might be joining us in the fun half. Mitch McConnell has provided photo evidence that he's alive. Dang it. ICE kills again, this time in Maine. Just days after killing a father in Houston. The story is still developing. IDF soldiers and armed settlers detained Congressman Ro Khanna in the West Bank over the weekend. We will also have a friend of the show, Jasper Nathaniel, on this week to discuss the escalating violence there and a separate attack he and his reporting team faced. The U.S. and Iran continue to exchange fire in the Strait of Hormuz as oil prices rise once again. Trump says blockade back on. It's just like, it feels like the same headlines, just recycling him. The DOJ subpoenas several New York Times journalists for reporting on the Qatari-donated Air Force One. The New York Times also reports that Marco Rubio is effectively in control of Venezuela. One in five Texas Hispanic business owners say they've had an employee deported in the last year. And among those surveyed, Tallarico has a 7-point lead. The bipartisan housing bill automatically became law over the weekend after Trump refused to sign it. Veto-proof majority. Multiple blue states are preparing to file a lawsuit to block Paramount's acquisition of Warner Brothers. And lastly, wildfires rage near Paris, and at least 12 people have been killed in southern Spain. This is Europe's third extreme heat wave of the summer. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome to the show, everybody. It is Monday. Fun day Monday. And we can actually say that with a little bit of gusto now. You may be wondering where Sam is. He's still out as a Hollywood bigwig. But these upcoming days, at least this week, he's going to be able to join for some parts of the show. So he will be joining us in the fun half for a little bit, unless, you know, he gets scheduled to do something else, you know? Yeah. We're not...
Take some kind of lunch meeting with a Hollywood executive.
Exactly. We're too small time for him now. So, we're partying. Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina, arguably the military-industrial complex's favorite creature of Washington. And when I say creature, I mean creature. He died on Saturday from a tear in his aorta. He was chairman of the Budget Committee, former chairman of the Judiciary Committee. You might remember him spitting and fuming and getting all red in the Kavanaugh hearings. You know, people might not remember that Lindsey Graham, despite being the most obvious closet case in America, ran for president in 2016. Yeah, he ran for president. He was one of those guys.
That.
Right. It's like remembering that Kirsten Gillibrand ran in 2020. You're like, what? That happened? Cory Booker did too. What? We'll get to Cory Booker, his hagiography about Lindsey Graham in the fun half probably. But, you know, he ran for president then and he lost pretty handily. And during that period, he was going on cable news and calling Trump a bigot and a xenophobe and said he represented the worst of America. He was against the Muslim ban. But it's a good reminder, I think, for people that any expedient rush to appear human by a senator that is this corrupted and is this okay with slaughtering children on behalf of moneyed interests can never be interpreted as anything more than aesthetic. Because as soon as Trump won that nomination, Lindsey Graham bent the knee. And he was essentially Trump's biggest cheerleader for the rest of his life. One of the biggest Zionist plant supporters in Congress. Look, it was an open secret that he was a gay man, but you have to wonder, given Mossad's extensive blackmail operation, if they had anything on him. I guess it doesn't really necessarily matter because what he supported stood on its own.
Use a war pig.
Yep. Boeing, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, and more were some of the major donors to him throughout his career. And they got what they paid for, baby. His last public appearance was at a Ukrainian drone factory, posing with weapons of war. like a kid on Christmas.
That's such a funny way to go.
I know, right? Oh, and also, like, apparently refusing medical attention because he was more interested in going on Meet the Press, which would also match his record of loving to be on camera and television.
Also, having this sort of a secret, as you alluded to earlier with Graham, that's just sitting with the Senate seat he took over from white supremacist Strom Thurmond, who had a secret black daughter himself. So, yeah, this sort of secrets... Yeah, it runs in the Republic. I mean,
in South Carolina. What's up with Tim Scott, the other senator from
the normal guy
from South Carolina? Yeah. Right, the normal guy who just got engaged.
Yeah. Anyway, lucky lady.
He was a like Lindsey Graham was not really interested in delivering for the people of South Carolina. His whole career is about committing wars and genocides overseas. That is his most consistent through line in terms of ideology. He was reportedly one of the people in Trump's ear pushing for this Iran war. He supported the Iraq war vigorously. He was furious that Biden withdrew from Afghanistan. He was a maximalist on Ukraine. And one of the most vocal supporters of the genocide in Gaza. Here is Lindsey Graham in an interview from earlier this year in February with Sky News Arabia, defending Israel's genocide in Gaza, just to give you a sense of how rabid this freak was.
When you look at the last few years since October 7th, many people in this part of the world say what happened in Gaza does not align with Christian values. Killing children, killing mothers,
well, be honest
killing
with
families.
You
are not militants.
Yeah, I don't buy that at all.
Why?
Because what did we do in World War II? Did we think 1 minute about starving the Germans? Did we bomb every city into to smithereens? So this
you
is a war.
No, October 7th to World War II.
Yes, I am. This is an absolute existential threat to the Jewish people. Mm. What happened on October the 7th?
Turned
1,200
camera.
People were slaughtered, watch. Raped, and murdered and filmed by radical Islamists who would kill every Jew if they could to the world. If you don't understand this is a threat to Israel,
and then they
survival,
flattened Gaza.
Just flatten it. We flattened Berlin. We flattened Tokyo. Were we wrong to drop an atomic bomb to end the Japanese reign of terror? Were we? So my view, if I were Israel, I would have probably done it the same way. Without military victory, there is no hope of breaking radicalism. We flattened Germany. We flattened Japan.
How many Americans
believe
this?
Out of that, we would...
How many Americans think the way that you do?
I think most Republicans think the way I do.
Even young ones.
You're just out of touch if you don't understand Republicans, when it comes to radical Islam, is on Israel's side. Mm. It's not even close.
Well, in terms of the political constituency that still supports Israel, he is right that that is solely based in the Republican Party, and not for nothing, this is the kind of thing that he wanted to cement, ironclad support for death and destruction abroad. You know, we keep calling him a closet case, but, like, we're kind of seeing in real time that perhaps people are a little less afraid of NDAs now. We can't verify any of this, but you could just look on the internet what some people are claiming. He was also a vigorous opponent of LGBTQ rights. So the hypocrisy of that is, you know, not lost on me here. And it's especially disgusting in that way, because he had immense wealth and privilege and knew that he could live his life in the way that he wanted to, supporting death and destruction while other people's rights were being stripped away from them. So, you know, and he overcompensated constantly by trying to prove his masculinity by being in favor as much death as humanly possible. So he's a pathetic figure in a variety, or was. He was a pathetic figure, I say, with a big smile on my face in many different ways. And so he's in death now being used exactly as he would have wanted, as a political football for two of his favorite people on the planet, Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu. Here is Trump in the immediate aftermath of, like, was Lindsey Graham even brought to the morgue at this point? How warm was his body when Trump calls in to push for the Save America Act and, you know, using Lindsey Graham as a way to do so?
Anybody like him? He was so intent. I mean, he literally called me about the Save America Act. That's why he's, you know, that's where I heard. Think of it. He's traveling for many, many hours. That's a long flight. Mm-hmm. That's a long trip. And he, you know, calls me about the Save America Act. He thought we were going to get it passed.
Do you remember this the very?
Big, yeah. This is a big this is a big blow to the Save America Act. Let me tell you.
Do you remember, Mr. President, what was the last thing you said to him? What was the last thing he said to you?
I said, "We'll see you soon. Come over anytime you want." He came into the White House a lot because I liked him. Can't do that with everybody, but he'd come in.
There's another part of this interview where he talks about Lindsey's golf game. They were frequent golf buddies, yeah. And has a critique of one of his swings.
Not a great striker of the ball.
You know, we got to be honest about people, even in death. Yeah. This was even more brazen. Benjamin Netanyahu went on Fox and Friends over the weekend to react to this as well, and this is how he characterizes his last conversation with Lindsey Graham.
Or whatever, okay. And I think once or twice he got his way, but let me tell you, the last conversation I had with him, I said, "Lindsey, we've come of age. We have a robust economy. We can take care of our own, financing our own weapons for the defense of Israel and defense of our common interests with America. So I'm going to phase out the support, the military support for Israel over a period of years and bring it down to zero. We can do it." And he went ballistic. He said, "No way, you can't do that," because he was so concerned with our security, which he believed was your security, that he actually fought the Prime Minister of Israel on keeping America's aid or actually increasing it. And that tells you what kind of a person this extraordinary friend was.
You know, you can't accuse Lindsey of being a slacker or not passionate about politics, because even as perhaps he felt his health ailing, he made a point to have two conversations about his political priorities. One with Trump about the Save America Act, which the Senate Majority Leader says we can't pass because we'd have to nuke the filibuster. But Lindsey was on Trump's side, says Trump. And Benjamin Netanyahu, coincidentally, they had a conversation in which he was saying, "Hey, we get it. We don't want any more U.S. military aid from the United States." And Lindsey said, "How dare you suggest that? Endless military aid from the United States to Israel." That's how on the ball he was, and how his priorities were always at the front of his mind.
How on message it is for Bibi Netanyahu. This is the most important thing going on in the imperial relationship between Israel and America right now, is this head fake of, "Oh yeah, we actually want to be independent from y'all," when the exact opposite is the case. This is from Responsible Statecraft. "Congress quietly moves to integrate U.S. and Israeli militaries in first steps towards shifting aid further into the shadows. The House's 2027 NDAA would all but fuse the two countries' armed forces together." This is insanity. And it's, I mean, of course, like somebody like Bibi Netanyahu isn't going to waste an opportunity to use the death of somebody who was his servant in life toward his own ends, of course.
And this is so controversial that later in that interview, we'll play that probably in the fun half, Benjamin Netanyahu was saying to the Fox and Friends crew that we're moving from an aid situation to a partnership. Which is exactly what you're saying. So they're trying to do this head fake because Netanyahu is quite adept at understanding American public opinion. And he sees that, like, perhaps, yeah, we've lost the Democrats and independents, but we need the Republican Party to stand firm on supporting Israel. And that you have younger Republicans that have this kind of more America first bent, where they don't want all of this money going overseas. They want it, yeah, invested in their communities. And I would say that's pretty bipartisan, frankly. It's just interesting that young Republicans are in that more isolationist worldview. So Netanyahu is seeing that, and he's trying to head it off, specifically also before potentially Democrats take back control in the midterms, and wants to move the ball forward on a permanent merging of the United States with Israel's military and their technology, as opposed to the just informal one that already exists, because then there would no longer be a question about U.S. military aid to Israel. It would be automatic. It would be funding it in the same way that we have taxes that fund for, you know, payroll taxes, not funded in the same way, but like it would be in a bucket where it wouldn't need to even be essentially considered at all. And that's horrifying. So it's interesting that even Fox News had some skepticism about that. But yeah, rest in piss, Lindsey Graham. if there's a hell, he'll be there. Not for wanting more than anybody in maybe the United States Senate to have as much blood on his hands as humanly possible.
It's a shame he got his Iraq war.
Frankly. Yep. And Iran war.
Actually, that's what I'm
talking about. Okay, yeah. Yeah. In a moment, we are going to be speaking to Caitlin Voges about the attempts to do this age verification stuff and why big tech wants it. But first, a word from some of our sponsors here. A lot of us have these subscriptions that we just completely forget about. You've got these ridiculous ones that you discover and you realize that, oh crap, like I should have been cutting back in this way. And you're often lucky to discover that too, if you're doing it on your own. But Rocket Money is the place you want to go if you want to do the deep dive into some of the crazy subscriptions that you want to help cancel. Rocket Money, I know, Brian, you've been a Rocket Money user for quite a while, and it helped get rid of some of the most ridiculous recurring subscriptions. Rocket Money can track subscriptions and has the ability to cancel unwanted ones within the app with a few taps, saving users over $880 million in canceled subscriptions. You can set budgets and goals, get personalized insights and regular reports, and receive real-time alerts for large transactions, upcoming bills, refunds, and low balances. Users who create a financial goal with Rocket Money save over $70 on average within the first 30 days. So you got, yeah, all of these subscription services that you're automatically kind of renewing, not necessarily paying attention to. That's how they get you. Well, Rocket Money can help you save money on all of that. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that helps find and cancel unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so you can grow your savings. Let Rocket Money help you reach your financial goals faster. Join rocketmoney.com/majority. That's rocketmoney.com/majority. rocketmoney.com/majority. Let Rocket Money help you reach your financial goals faster. rocketmoney.com/majority. We will put a link to that down below in the video and episode descriptions and at majority.fm. And lastly, did you know that Fast Growing Trees is America's largest and most trusted online nursery with thousands of trees and plants and over 2 million happy customers? They have all the plants your yard or home needs, including fruit trees, privacy trees, flowering trees, shrubs, and houseplants, all grown with care and guaranteed to arrive healthy. It's like your local nursery, but anywhere you live, and with more plants than you'll find anywhere else. And you don't have to say, you know, if you don't have a car like me, take it on the subway, go find the right nursery. It comes right to your door, and it helps you find options that work for your climate, space, and lifestyle. Fast Growing Trees makes it easy to get your dream yard. Just click, order, grow, and get healthy, thriving plants delivered to your door. I want to find, you know, a house plant. I found a house plant through Fast Growing Trees. And you got to say, like, I need this to be safe for the cats. I need this to be able to have this kind of light or low light situation. How many times is it going to get watered? Well, Fast Growing Trees has all of the tools that can help you determine what plant is right for your home or for your garden. Their Alive and Thrive guarantee promises your plants arrive happy and healthy, no green thumb required, just quality plants that you can count on. Plus, get ongoing support from trained plant experts who can help you plan your landscape, choosing the right plants, and learn how to care for them every step of the way. Right now, they have great deals on planting essentials, up to half off on select plants. And our audience gets 20% off your first purchase when using the code MAJORITY at checkout. That's an additional 20% off better plants and better growing at fastgrowingtrees.com using the code MAJORITY at checkout. Fastgrowingtrees.com, code MAJORITY. Now is the perfect time to plant. Let's grow together. Use MAJORITY to save today. Offer is valid for a limited time. Terms and conditions may apply. Get 20% off your first purchase at fastgrowingtrees.com/majority. We will put a link down below in the video and episode descriptions and at majority.fm. Quick break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Caitlin Vogas. We are back, and we are joined now by Caitlin Vogas, Senior Advisor to the Freedom of the Press Foundation and a First Amendment attorney. Caitlin is here to talk about her piece published in partnership with The Intercept and the Freedom of the Press Foundation, Online Age Verification Law Could Kill Whistleblowing. Caitlin, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me, Emma.
Of course. So let's just start, I guess, from a few weeks ago when the House passed the KIDS Act and sent it to the Senate. Overall, what is the KIDS Act? How did it pass? And what is in this bill?
Sure. So the KIDS Act is a package of bills that combines actually a lot of different pieces of legislation, and they're all framed around this idea of online safety and protecting kids online. And that is, of course, a framing that I think anyone can get behind. We all want to keep kids safe, of course. But the issue with the bill is that buried within it, it also really strongly either incentivizes or actually requires social media platforms to engage in age verification or age gating, saying that social media platforms could be held liable if they offer certain content or certain features to kids. And the question comes up of, well, how could they do that unless they could determine which of their users are kids and which are adults? And the answer is that they can't. And so the bill would require platforms to use these kind of very invasive measures, invasive of people's privacy, in order to determine their ages. And that's where our concern is coming from at Freedom of the Press Foundation, where I work.
So it begs the question, if they're kids, they don't have IDs. So how is age verification going to be implemented? They know that there are different, I mean, maybe when they're 16 or 15, but earlier than that, no, they don't have IDs that they can use. Like, how is this being promoted, and how do they think that they're going to be able to implement this?
Right. That's a great question. So one of the methods for age verification is requiring a user to produce a government ID, as you mentioned. And as you say correctly, kids, you know, below a certain age are not going to have that ID. But it's not just kids below a certain age. It also might be people who are in the country and are undocumented, or it might be people who just don't have the money in order to get a government ID, things like that. So it could impact a lot of people. If platforms are not requiring a government ID, another way that they might try to verify age is through biometric data. So they might take a scan of a user's face and then try to estimate their age based on that scan. But a problem with that is, not only is that extremely privacy invasive, I don't want to have to share a scan. to go onto a social media platform, it also is not always accurate. And studies have shown that it's especially not accurate when dealing with people of color, for example. So there are different methods, but none of them are foolproof. And I think the biggest problem with all of them is that there's no way to verify someone's age but allow them to still remain anonymous online. And that's a huge issue when it comes to free speech and our ability to speak online.
I'm just also thinking about, naturally, yes, children of color might, you know, be impacted and it's not accurate for them. But I also think about, say, like, the biometric data for trans kids who are especially vulnerable right now. The idea that they would have to subject themselves to face scans as minors presents a whole host of problems. And also, almost, even though it says it's protecting kids, this is a privacy violation and a parental rights violation.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the impact on LGBTQ youth is really severe. And groups like Fight for the Future have been bringing that argument to the forefront, because we know that the internet has been a place for some of those kids where they can connect with communities of other LGBTQ people to help them navigate what can be a really difficult process for them as they are in communities that might not be supportive for them. And so the impacts on that group in particular can be very problematic. People who want to maybe criticize or speak out against the government, their anonymity being impacted is extremely important. And from our perspective at Freedom of the Press Foundation, as a press freedom organization, the impact on journalists and confidential sources who might want to speak anonymously online together is it's hugely problematic to require them to verify their ages and therefore reveal their identities in order to get online.
And I want to touch on that huge element as well. But I just also wanted to put a point on the fact that this is kind of a rebranding of an argument that I remember growing up with and that still exists today. Like Texas, I know, is cracking down on the availability of online pornography. But like, this is a way almost like to say we're protecting our kids from this big, scary internet. This is an argument that was said all the time from a more, you know, right wing Heritage Foundation, conservative evangelical corner of our politics, but now it's coming through the, you know, big tech's lobbying, which is an interesting development to me.
Yeah, absolutely. This is an argument that is rewarmed from the fights in the 1990s when the Communications Decency Act was passed. That was a law that was about obscenity online. The Supreme Court struck down most of that law, saying it violated the First Amendment. Now we're seeing those same arguments being rehashed. And as you said, some of the big tech companies are even embracing this because they know that they might be able to comply with these requirements, and they don't really care about users' privacy, and they could maybe drive their smaller competitors out of business. So that's another reason why these bills are very problematic. If we want a free internet that's not just dominated by the big tech platforms, well, this legislation is not going to give us that.
So what are the big companies that are behind this bill? Who are they? Why is it kind of being, I mean, we know why, but I just feel like the national conversation around this has not caught up to the fact that there are tech companies that are pushing this. This isn't a tech regulatory bill in the same way that, you know, in the way that it's being framed as some sort of protection from big tech.
Yeah, that's a great point. The tech companies have changed their positions at various times, and so I don't want to speak incorrectly as to which ones may or may not be endorsing this particular bill, because also, as I said, this legislation has a lot of different bills that have been kind of smashed into it. In the Senate, there's another version. So it is changing all the time who is supporting what. But unfortunately, we have seen some of the big tech companies come out and say that they would be okay with requirements like this, like age verification. I think that should be disturbing and send the signal that maybe this is not the route we should be going.
So on the piece for journalists and, you know, Trump's attacks on journalists, this coming within this context, I mean, largely there have also been bipartisan attacks on activism, particularly around Palestine, where this could be really, really problematic. But talk about the risk for journalism and for whistleblowers who would need to be able to provide information to journalists, what these barriers would do to that.
Sure. Well, there's no doubt that the Trump administration has essentially declared war on the free press. Just this past weekend, we saw that the Department of Justice subpoenaed New York Times journalists over their reporting about the Qatari jet that was offered to President Trump. They're trying to uncover the reporter's confidential sources. And this has been a repeated theme by this administration. They want to go after the confidential sources and the whistleblowers who are helping journalists hold them to account. And so the way that these laws could impact that is by essentially chipping away at or even destroying anonymity online. And we know that one of the ways that journalists connect with confidential sources is through online communications. And in the past, we've seen the Trump administration, but also other administrations, try to target journalists' emails, for example, to see who are they emailing with, who are their confidential sources they're talking with. And so if all of a sudden you have to prove your identity to use a social media platform, that opens up a whole new pot of data that the Trump administration or a future administration could target to try to discover who are journalists talking to on social media. Send a legal demand to the tech company and make them tell us. And so that's extremely concerning when we need confidential sources and whistleblowers more than ever to know that we could be opening a whole other avenue for the government to crack down on it.
So it's basically like, you know, if you are a source that's reaching out to a journalist on social media versus a, you know, secure communications platform like Signal, you could be immediately targeted by the administration for that purpose. And secondarily, my question would be, how does it impact some of the encrypted communications apps like Signal? Would this be difficult for those kind of communications to continue?
Well, lawmakers are usually careful to say that they don't intend the legislation to impact encrypted services, but I know the Electronic Frontier Foundation has taken a look at the KIDS Act, and they say buried within the bill, there are hints that it could impact encryption as well because of the liability regime, that it could make platforms liable if they don't take action on certain content. And then the issue becomes, well, if it's encrypted, the platform's not supposed to know what content is being shared. So how could they possibly take action on certain content? So it's complicated, but I think the answer is that there's at least the possibility it could impact encrypted communications, which is very concerning. We always recommend at Freedom of the Press Foundation that journalists use secure communication tools like Signal if they're going to talk with confidential sources. But the truth is that some sources also are not sophisticated, and so they might make their initial outreach to reporters through unencrypted platforms, just on social media. And so in that case, the bill really comes into play again with the issue around age verification and platforms collecting people's identifying information.
We have someone who wrote in and asked, more bad news says, could you ask how VPN usage fits into this?
Sure. So with VPN usage, what we've seen with bills around the country, so in different states, they've passed laws that require age verification, maybe banning kids under a certain age from certain social media platforms. And as they have passed those bills, what we've seen is that people in those states have turned to VPNs because they don't want to turn over their private information to tech companies. And so they use a VPN to try to get around it. But now lawmakers are taking notice of that, and they're actually trying to maybe potentially ban VPNs. So recently, Utah became one of the first states to propose banning VPN usage in certain situations to try to crack down on this getting around of age verification. But that's a huge can of worms to open, because VPNs do a lot more than just help people evade censorship and age verification. They also help people keep themselves safe online, keep their browsing private. And so we're really headed down, I'd say, a slippery path where you start cracking down on the platforms. Lawmakers see, oh, that's not working as well as we hope. Now we're going to crack down on VPNs. And what's next? I mean, more and more content could be banned and censored. So it's very concerning.
Lastly, just from a big picture perspective, you mentioned how it's a very natural impulse right now for people to want their children to be protected online, right? And so that's why this bill is being framed as the Kids Act and protecting children. From your perspective, I know this is a little bit a field of the, you know, talking about whistleblowers, right? But, you know, what would be possible as a way for children to be protected from some of the worst parts of the internet without using systems like this? I mean, I've seen some of these studies about phone bans in schools. That seems fair to me. I know this is different, but, like, you know, I don't necessarily know if there's a way or if there should be a way to obstruct children from accessing the internet and outside of, you know, parents kind of getting involved here?
Well, I think one thing that Congress could do that would protect not only children, but all of us would be to pass comprehensive privacy legislation that governs online services. And what I mean by that is targeting the tech platform's collection of people's data that they then use to run their behavioral ad systems. Mm. And that's the engine that's powering all of this. Tech platforms are sucking in people's data and then using it to target advertisement. And that is going a long way towards the harms that we're seeing kids, but everybody online encounter. So instead of requiring platforms to collect more data to verify users' ages, instead, what I think Congress should be doing is cracking down on data collection through comprehensive privacy legislation that covers everyone, children and adults alike.
Because then you would be unable to specifically target children with harmful content, because there would not be the mass data collection that would allow for these tech companies to target them via all the information they've collected, essentially.
Right, exactly. And not just kids, but all of us. None of us want to be targeted with this terrible content. So yes, it would go a long way to protecting kids and adults.
Yes, I'm foregrounding the kids thing because there's just like, you know, this puritanical anxiety about this certain stuff. And look, I'm not a parent yet, so I don't get it. But that is what they're trying to tap into. Regardless, I really appreciate your time today. You clarified a lot about this dangerous bill. Lastly, you said that there's a Senate version. Do you know what the status is of this bill now that it's passed the House? Are they debating it in the Senate? Is it a new version they're trying to meld with this House version?
The Senate has its own version of the bill, and I think there's actually a lot of competition between the House and Senate. The Senate is dissatisfied with the House version. The House is dissatisfied with the Senate version. So far, they have not been able to make progress on passing a version that they can both agree on, which I think goes to show how problematic the legislation is. Congress can't come together to work out the details because both bills are ultimately extremely flawed.
Well, Caitlin Voges, senior advisor to the Freedom of the Press Foundation, First Amendment attorney. You can read her piece published in partnership with The Intercept and the Freedom of the Press Foundation called Online Age Verification Law Could Kill Whistleblowing. Caitlin, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Of course. All right, folks, quick break. And when we return from our break, you will be hearing an interview that we have a note on from our friend Matt Leck. Between Alex Aronson and Sam.
Yeah, there was a little bit of an issue with Sam's microphone here, so we had to sort of doctor up the onboard microphone there. So it will sound like Sam's coming in over a little bit of a bad connection, but the guest mic sounds great, and so just accept our apologies.
Sam didn't pick the right mic in his recording.
I was trying to finesse that a little bit, but yeah, I think that is basically what happened. But it is legible. So there were good questions and even better answers. So
yes.
Here's this.
Yes, Alex Aronson, I should say, co-founder and executive director of Court Accountability on the Supreme Court corruption and the billionaire-backed right-wing takeover of the courts. Here's that interview now.
We are back, Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Joining me now, it's a pleasure to welcome to the program Alex Aronson. He is the co-founder and executive director of Court Accountability and a contributor to Midas Touch's Legal AF. Alex, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Sam. Great to be with you.
So we're talking literally just hours, more or less, 24, I guess, technically, from the end of the Supreme Court's term. We have seen their rulings. Of that batch, before we get into sort of like the more holistic, a problem with the Supreme Court that I think hopefully this audience is pretty familiar with. What was the most disturbing? I mean, I know it's hard to sort of like pick one, but what did you find the most disturbing, I guess, from a broad structural problem?
Yeah, it is really hard to pick one, because I think almost the most disturbing thing about the end of the term is the entire end of term ritual itself. This sort of baroque and grotesque process whereby we all sit around and wait to find out which of our rights and freedoms survive the latest John Roberts decree. It really, I think, shines a spotlight on just how broken the entire system is and how much power we've allowed this court to sort of take on for itself. Of the actual decisions that came down, I think two really stand out. One came several weeks ago, of course, the Calais decision, the real culmination of a decades-long project to gut the Voting Rights Act that John Roberts, the Chief Justice of the United States, has really been at the helm of. And then of this week's decision, I think the one that we must pay extra special attention to is the decision in the FTC case about the independence of the FTC, which really was more about Congress's power to, on behalf of the American people, set up these independent agencies and insulate them from this type of obscene political interference like we're seeing from Trump. And again, just like Calais, this represented the culmination of a decades-long project funded by right-wing billionaires to basically overturn the administrative state and put in place this tyrannical presidency that that Congress simply can't touch. So those two cases really stand out within this broader context of a court that has become masterful at dominating the narrative and, I think, creating the impression that it is a guardrail against authoritarianism when it is, in fact, authoritarianism's central driver in this country.
Yeah, it's interesting when you talk about Calais and you talk about the FTC, I guess, Fed dual ruling, as it were. Those are really structural issues. Like the 14th Amendment and the birthright citizenship is almost feels like that's the project for that we provide for chum on some level. I mean, like I feel like certainly. The Voting Rights Act, we know John Roberts, that was his pet project in the early 1980s when he's working in the DOJ for Reagan. And Calais is the sort of like culmination of an assault on the Voting Rights Act since 2013. It may have predated, obviously, there was a big problem the Republicans had with the Voting Rights Act years before that, of course, since 65. The naturally born, the birthright citizenship feels like if you had asked your typical Federalist Society lawyer 8 years ago, 10 years ago, they would have been like, what? No,
Right. Of course. Absolutely. This came out of thin air. It's egregious overreach. Normally, when the right wing legal movement has a target like this, it takes a lot of time to develop a whole doctrinal assault on the existing precedent. Right. This is the work that we did in the Senate, the work that we do at Court Accountability to expose this multi-$100 billion scheme to invest in the development of doctrines and fake facts and an entire apparatus to advance this stuff. And normally that's what we see. It's what we've seen in pretty much every other doctrinal context. And here, this Trump-driven attack on birthright citizenship was not similarly supported by that type of infrastructure. It was just a couple scholars at the last minute who threw this stuff out. And so I think you're right. On some level, it's less structural. I do think there's a structural dynamic here, right? They're trying to define what citizenship means so that they can start to really continue to shape who gets to be a person in this country and who gets to have political equality. But, you know, I think it's striking and jarring that this frivolous theory that had no backing even from this movement got four votes from this court, which suggests, and I saw you had Ellie Mistel on the show yesterday. He's terrific. I'm sure he got into this, but this is not over, right? They're going to continue to hammer at this, and Alito or Thomas will retire, and they're going to re-up their majority. And these projects are far from over on citizenship, immigration, but many other issues also.
I know you're steeped in the how we got to this point, and we've sort of just touched on it a little bit, but let's fill in some of the gaps, because I think there's a tendency, first off, from the center left, I would say a real problem with fundamentally understanding how powerful the Supreme Court is and how relevant it is. I can be supportive of Medicare for all. I am. But there's no reason to believe that if the House and the Senate and the president were to pass and sign Medicare for All, that it wouldn't get struck down, at least with the court as composed today, maybe even less so going forward. And that is by design. Take us back to, I guess this starts really in many respects, the Powell memo is the sort of like the opening shot in this assault on the judiciary. What did they understand? Or what did the right at that point sort of like, how clear was their agenda in terms of going forward?
Yeah, it was pretty clear at the time. I think what they understood was power. They understood the structure and design of the Constitution, which parts of it were you know, susceptible to sort of democratic progress and democratic power that had produced a whole bunch of stuff that these interests really did not like by the time that the Powell memo was conceived in 1971, right? We had seen, and this was a bipartisan push towards broad consumer worker rights, social and economic progress, the civil rights movement. These were all the products of mostly congressional democratic action. And they recognized that if they could concentrate and hold power within the less democratic features of our Constitution, such as the judiciary, they would be able to choke off that progress, take us backwards, and foreclose future progress. So that was the sort of structural design of the Federalist Society right-wing legal project that did really begin in earnest with the Powell memo. But you could trace it back earlier to the reaction to Brown versus Board of Education and racial integration, right? This was actually, I think, the true origins of political originalism, which was offered as a more palatable alternative to just straight up racist nullification of Supreme Court orders as the court was ordering schools to be integrated. And so right-wing thinkers like William F. Buckley in the National Review actually started developing originalism as a way to reach the same outcomes, but under the pretext of neutrality. And the Powell memo really brought in right-wing industrial and corporate money to infuse this into a whole movement. And it took power. And I think, you know, we have spent a lot, I'm sure your listeners are familiar with much of the story of the investment and of the organization and coordination by Leonard Leo and the Federalist Society toward the installment of these justices with folks like Roberts and Alito in the George W. Bush administration. But I think what we spend less time thinking about, which is just as important, perhaps more important, and something we can actually do something about, is the way that the liberal left, the Democratic Party, the media treated this incursion on our Constitution, treated this court capture scheme, right? Because I think the main mistake we collectively have made for all of these decades is to think of the courts, first and foremost, as the place to go for democracy and justice and equal rights. And then to mistake what originalism was as sort of a good faith intellectual adversary across the aisle, you know, in terms of this jurisprudence to go back to original intent. We took it at face value and engaged with it directly rather than acknowledging it as a pretextual vehicle for an authoritarian political project. And along the way, we have been unwilling to call out what has become an untenable concentration of constitutional power within the federal judiciary, and particularly at the Supreme Court. And this was the problem that Lincoln recognized with the Taney Court when they were dealing with Dred Scott and slavery, right? And he understood, and this is I'm sure I'll botch it, but I'll try. Lincoln understood and said in his first inaugural address that if the policy of the whole government is to be on vital questions affecting the whole people, is to be irrevocably fixed by the Supreme Court, then the people will have ceased to be their own rulers. And that's the condition we're living under now, right? Where even though 80% of America wants the same outcomes on questions like money and politics, even more than that, it's 87% that reject Citizens United. We can't have that result because we have ceased to be our own rulers because we are living in a legal autocracy where the Supreme Court, this tribunal with ultimate and exclusive prerogative over the meaning of the Constitution, has set the terms for our lives. And until we reject their claim to that exclusive control over constitutional meaning, which is not in the Constitution. That is a norm, like all of the other norms. Until we reject that, we are stuck in the system because they have the Supreme Court majority until 2065 at the earliest. And there are ways out, though. There are ways out.
Yes, and I want to get to those. And the it is fascinating to me, having like been, I spent a year in law school, at the beginning of the '90s. The fire hose of originalism and textualism, and as if these were sort of, like you say, good faith principles that were to be argued, and they were. I mean, I just, every time I hear it, I just think of like a Breyer, you know, talking about, I believe in a living constitution, and trying to debate these questions. And now we hear none of that. There is like, it's identical to sort of like the way that the deficit was used as a mechanism to cut Social Security. And then when it is no longer convenient to talk about the deficit, we don't. I'm really struck by that. Let's talk about hopefully this audience has some awareness of the need for a reform of the Supreme Court. And there's a lot of really interesting different ways of doing it that are not terribly radical. And obviously the first thing is to get people to engage and recognize the problem that we're dealing with, and how incredibly corrupted the process has been by money and by a politicization. And this, and before we get into these, one of the frustrations I have is that the legal profession itself, which I think ultimately needs to be on board with this and accept the reality of this. And I'm talking about the legal profession that are theoretically non-ideological. They still can't. I mean, and, you know, part of this is shaped by like my own dealing with my father, who's, you know, in his 80s. But, you know, time and time again, I bring to him like cases that I'm like, this is garbage. And there's still this sort of like lawyer mentality. These are very smart people. They're very accomplished. And there is a grace that is given that is sort of otherworldly. How do you deal with that?
I think it's starting to unwind a little bit. I talk to a lot of judges, former judges, a lot of folks who certainly, I think, fall into this camp of people that have looked at people like John Roberts as an institutionalist. They might disagree with his jurisprudence, but they ultimately think he's principled. I do think that in the last few years, with decisions like Trump versus the United States, the immunity decision, with leaks out of the Supreme Court, like we've seen, there was this explosive leak showing the creation of the shadow docket in the context of Obama's Clean Power Plan, where John Roberts effectively said, we can't allow this to happen. It would have too negative an impact on the fossil fuel industry. He said that in internal memos that got leaked. And I think as people see these results, the line that this is still a court in any sense, that it is not simply doing the bidding of the interests that put these justices in place, is less and less tenable. But I think you're right. It's, you know, what we're working against is decades of entrenched cultural attachment to the idea that the court is above the law. And what we must do, I believe, and it's why we started at Court Accountability with research and investigative work to help uncover the sprawling goldmine of corruption and scandal that had been encircling this court, that the mainstream media didn't want to touch, that the Democrats didn't want to touch. But it's by continuing to expose that, to show just how extreme and radical not only the justices themselves, but the people behind them calling the shots for this agenda really are, that are going to start to do it. And I think the other thing that's happening, and Calais, to my mind, having done this now for over 10 years working in this space, was the first thing that finally seemed to have flipped the switch with the Democrats, like the mainstream leadership of the Democratic Party, that I think understands for the first time, perhaps, that there is no future for the Democratic Party unless they take this seriously. And so what that looks like in terms of a reform agenda, I think, is the work of the next really like 2 years. But I think the realization is starting to dawn on.
Was it not Bush v. Gore? That was the, I mean, not just the canary in the coal mine. That was like a much larger bird in the coal mine.
And then John Roberts' nomination as Chief Justice just 5 years later after he had been, you know, a lawyer on that case.
If I remember correctly, and I think Kavanaugh was working on that case too, frankly. But I think Roberts or Kavanaugh, they were in that mob that was the Brooks Brothers riot. And so I don't. For me, that was the biggie.
If you look at the way the Democrats treated John Roberts' nomination, he wasn't like a threat. He got a lot of Democratic votes. Barack Obama, I've heard from leaders who were working on that nomination at the time, Barack Obama wanted to vote for John Roberts' confirmation and was told that if he did, he would have no chance of being the party's nominee. But this this reflects the Democratic Party's complete miss on what they were up against when it came to judicial power and where this project was headed in terms of the permanent destruction of American democracy.
I think a turn in that I think people can see it, like a material difference is the judiciary now, and we're seeing it with some executive branch appointments, asking the question, who won the 2020 election, just to lay bare how non-independent these independent judicial nominees are, and their failure to simply say, like, yeah, it's noontime, the sun is shining, is I think indicative. And I think it's indicative of where the Democrats have moved, that we're starting to see this on a regular basis. I think that's rather healthy. Let's talk about the reform ideas. There's a lot of them floating out there. What are the ones that you think, based upon your experience working for Sheldon Whitehouse, who's on the Judiciary Committee, and what you've heard in talking to people, what do you think is both the most effective and sort of like cross-referenced with the most doable?
Yeah. This is a big question, super thorny. There are so many reforms that are needed to deal with so many problems that have emerged from our courts by virtue of the Federalist Society's capture scheme. We don't have time probably to get into all of the reforms that are needed to restore public faith and to have a court that's a court again. I do think it's likely that if for any pro-democracy agenda, like a substantive agenda to survive, some reform will be needed, some aggressive reform to constrain this court will be needed. Something like expanding the court, putting justices on the court, or deploying other less widely understood, talked about reforms like jurisdiction stripping. The Constitution gives Congress significant authority to set the jurisdiction of the federal courts, both the lower federal courts and the Supreme Court. So it could use its powers to carve out jurisdictional exceptions to entire areas of cases where the courts would no longer have jurisdiction to meddle in democratically enacted laws.
How does that work? Like insofar as, you know, we're going to pass a law that says Black people can't vote. And we have now said that the Supreme Court no longer has jurisdiction over voting issues that we have passed. How does that work?
Right. Inadvertently, or maybe not inadvertently, and you have taken the invitation, but we've opened the door to the nuclear question in constitutional law and federal courts, which is the scope of Congress's power to strip the courts out of the picture. And the concern that you raise is a very real one for a situation in which a sort of an authoritarian majority might want to do something like you describe, and where we would want the courts to maintain a role, right? And the 20th century is a good proof point for the importance of having courts, particularly in the context of checking state power, right? I think we think too much about the good that the court has done in sort of the absence. Most of the good that the court has done in the 20th century was in the context of checking state authoritarianism. And so, you know, there are real concerns about what could happen if Congress starts to use these powers to check the court. What I would argue is that it tends to be more democratic. There's a reason the Federalist Society and this, you know, faction of billionaires and extremists chose the unaccountable power of the courts to drive their agenda is because they couldn't advance it through the Congress. Right. And so we've seen efforts from the right to actually use jurisdiction stripping to advance a national right to life, to ban gay marriage nationwide. That never took hold. And in fact, those efforts in the 2000s were snuffed out by the Federalist Society folks who said, this isn't the way. The way to ban abortion nationwide is through the courts. Right. And so these are questions that we need to get right as we think about what we think American democracy should look like. And I think they're not easy to resolve. One last thing I'll say is that, you know, whatever reform we need to advance, we have to reckon with the fact that the broken political system this court created is still very much in play within the Democratic Party, which is deeply infected by the unlimited money in politics that Citizens United and before that Buckley versus Valeo unleashed. And so while we might know in our community here that something like court expansion is necessary, the chances of the next nominee sticking their neck out to advance that, I think, are very, very small. And I think we have to, rather than just get upset about that, we have to work with it. I actually think there are real reasons why the next nominee might not want to stick their neck out on something like court expansion, even if it is something that they plan on ultimately trying to advance, because we enter this fight from way behind. Yeah. Our adversaries have spent 50 years cultivating a base that understands the power of the courts, and we simply haven't. And if we start to advance the most aggressive, far-reaching reforms, we're going to walk into a propaganda buzzsaw. You know, we have talked about it in this conversation, the cultural and mythological attachments that so many in even the pro-democracy community attach to this court. And I would just simply suggest that as we prepare for what must be an ultimate contestation for power against a corrupt and authoritarian judiciary, we should be strategic about how to enter that fight with the most legitimacy and the most durable public support behind our cause as we possibly can. And I think in a moment like this, where we all know that this is not tenable and we need something like court packing, it might feel good to demand that our elected representatives come out front and start calling for things like that. But I would suggest that there are actually better ways to approach the challenge.
And let's just talk one of those, because I heard an interview you did with Representative Sean Caspin from Illinois. Who had some interesting ideas on this. And one of the ones that I think really struck me was, and this is part of it, you know, people talk about expanding it to 13 because that's the number of appellate courts we have, or the idea of essentially having a much bigger, a rotating Supreme Court, which would include theoretically, I guess, all the appellate courts or maybe a couple of them, where the practice of we're going to have somebody go in and try and deny a cake by a gay couple, and that's not going to be our test court case, and we're sending that out because we know we can rely on these five votes up on the court, and now's the time to do this. You'd be unable to do that if you had a rotating crew. Just briefly lay that out, because one of the things I really like about that is it's so processy sounding that it feels like you can't really call it radical because nobody's going to pay attention. Your average voter's just like, whatever, there's an appellate court. Like, they don't know, you know, your average, it's much harder to gain traction. Saying court packing sounds, even though we're seeing it in half a dozen states, we've seen it essentially under Republican rule. But talking about a rotating 9-person Supreme Court where each justice spends 6 months on the court or a year on the court or whatever it is, seems to me to be something that sounds so weedy to people that it's very hard to argue to demagogue against, I guess.
Yeah. I love Representative Caston. I think he's unique, not unique, but he's one of the few in the House and in the Congress generally who is willing to think creatively and to think about how to address these problems with powers that Congress has, I think, been too quick to ignore or leave collecting dust. He understands the power that Congress has to set jurisdiction limits, to create different structures of courts like he has proposed. I think there's a lot of appeal in a proposal like he has laid out, or like you're suggesting there. We could have 100 Supreme Court justices and random panels. I think we could make a strong, good government case for that. I do have concerns that like people would see through it. We are up against a propaganda juggernaut and a base that really understands the importance of this. And it reminds me a bit of the pretextual justifications that FDR actually offered for his court packing threat, which were that the justices were too old and overworked and needed support, which the American people didn't buy, and really was a threat that only worked because FDR had tremendous political power on his side. He had 76 votes in the Senate, and we simply don't have that type of power. And so what I would offer is that, and we haven't done the work to advance court reforms, even sort of good government, super defensible court reforms as a big priority for our base and for the Democratic Party. And so the way we think about it is, how can we advance this agenda in a way that brings more people along and that highlights just how obscene and out of control this system has gotten? And where we think the place to start is with the corrupt, broken political system and with money in politics. Citizens United and Buckley versus Valeo, the 1976 case that decided that money was speech and that really opened the door for this broken political system that we're all inhabiting. This was a very intentional design of the Federalist Society Project and the Chamber of Commerce's Powell memo. And we've all sort of accepted that to deal with Citizens United, we have to overturn Citizens United by amending the Constitution. Now, that is an impossibility. They have broken the political system to foreclose our ability to do that. And we have taken it as an acceptable answer for a democratic reformer, a pro-democracy, anti-corruption reformer, to say that they are against Citizens United and that they want to overturn Citizens United by amending the Constitution. But people like Hakeem Jeffries, who make those promises, they know that those are promises they will never have to deliver because of the broken political system that they are now caught up in. And so what if we just stop accepting that we have to take the Supreme Court's word as final, like Lincoln did? And on a question like Citizens United, where every fact that they laid out in that case, supplanting Congress's bipartisan factual findings with their own assertions that independent expenditures could not be corrupting, everything about that decision is wrong. Everything about the 16 now years since it was decided has proven that to 87% of the Americans that, in fact, independent expenditures in politics are deeply corrupting and create the appearance of corruption. And so what if we try to just overturn that by statute, rejecting their claim to final exclusive control over the meaning of the Constitution? I think we could build a coalition around that. And I think it would be pretty hard for folks to start saying no to a bill that just does that, because it's something that 90% of the country wants that we can't have because we live in a judicial tyranny.
And that provides a roadmap, theoretically, both has material impact on the ability to get more reforms in the future, but also provides a roadmap of how you do it in terms of essentially jurisdiction stripping.
You nailed it.
It's fascinating stuff. If folks want more information, they can find court accountability where?
We are at courtaccountability.org, and don't miss our sister research organization, True North Research, led by my partner, the incomparable Lisa Graves.
All right. And we'll link to both of those, and as well as Midas Touch's Legal AF. Alex Aronson, I really appreciate your time today. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Sam.
Hello, and look who it is.
Oh, hello, everyone.
Hello. I'd like to welcome to the show, how do you pronounce it? How do you say it?
It is, it's Cedar. It's Sam Cedar, yeah.
Gotcha. Oh,
Sam? I've been saying it wrong the whole time.
Yeah. Hi, folks. I am still on the road, as you can see, and will be for a couple of weeks, but I'm going to be joining the fun half today. I'm still trying to record some stuff remotely. Feels like it was a busy week last week.
Yeah, what'd you miss?
All the Jaylen Brown talk must have been dominant.
Of course.
Yeah, obviously missed a lot of stuff. I'm going to talk a little bit about that in the fun half when we got back. I just wanted to clear up some rumors about my involvement with Mitch McConnell falling. I had nothing to do with that. As far as other things that have been going on, I think it I can't really talk about the project I'm working on now. It is a sort of a Hollywood thing, but it's going to create a lot of controversy relative.
Cutting out.
And passing away.
Hollywood took you out, took your signal out for a second there.
It's going to cause a lot of controversy with what did you say?
With the Lindsey Graham passing away, people are going to.
Oh, gosh.
It's going great right now.
Don't, Sam. Don't admit anymore.
I'm going to have to refresh Sam.
All right, we'll refresh you. But all right, that's the that's the teaser for Sam, then, for the fun half. All right, we'll fix this, Sam, going into the fun half. Matt, what's happening on Left Reckoning and with the Jacobin Show?
Ishmael Johnson's going to be talking about a piece on the cost of youth soccer and why it is actually the capitalization of these sorts of youth sports is making us less competitive relative to the rest of the world, and some other great stories. So check that out coming up on tomorrow's Left Reckoning.
That's all sports now in this country.
I didn't realize baseball was like the most expensive because that was like the one that we never had to like raise money for as a kid. Yeah, it's nuts.
Tomorrow I am going to be hosting the official launch of DSA's new Workers Deserve More program. It is going to be Tuesday the 14th. You can go to the link go.dsausa.org/WDM for Workers Deserve More dash Emma, but we'll also put a link down below in the video and episode descriptions. It's going to be at 8:30 p.m. Eastern tomorrow night. It's virtual over Zoom, so check it out, folks, if you want to get more involved in DSA and know what their upcoming program is for the 2026-2027 year. You can join me there. All right. See you in the fun half.
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What?
What is that going on? It's nuts. Wait a second. Hold on for a second.
The Majority Report.
Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt!
Who?
Fun.
What is up, everyone?
Fun. Nomi Key.
You did it!
Fun.
Let's go, Brandon!
Fun. Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today!
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But, dude, you want to smoke this,
7-8? Yes.
Hi, me? Is this me?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
Oh, I'm going to go for a ride.
Libertarians.
They're so stupid, though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge Matt.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-35-501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop.
We call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all, my favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
the weak being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out.
I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled,
wow,
folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock. We're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.
Back.
We are back. It is the fun half, and Sam is here from an undisclosed location.
Yes, indeed. haven't had the opportunity to be live on the show since the new revelations about Plattner came out, and since he's dropped out of the race. and, you know, I think we were supportive of his candidacy in many respects. I think we relied on the redemption narrative that he was pushing. And I think, it was quite clear that he never really ultimately held himself to account for some of those things. And it's hard for me to imagine that he was not aware of these other allegations when he said there's nothing else coming out.
Because the Times had spoken to this the woman Jenny, who is accusing him of rape, and it wasn't in the Times piece, but he knew that woman was spoken to, and then still went on Chris Hayes and other programs and said nothing new was coming out, which is insane,
right?
And dereliction of duty to the voters, to his campaign, at the very least.
And, it's impossible for us to know, really, what his campaign people knew or didn't know, or what specific people knew what or when. I imagine that, you've made it clear that we're not in a position to know any more than what is already out there. Now, there were definitely some people who felt like the red flags and all the other scandals that had come up were indicative of somebody who was not taking full account for what Plattner had done years before, and that's a judgment call, and their judgment was correct in this instance. And this is going to be, we're going to have situations not identical to this, but if there is going to be an attempt to change the Democratic Party, in many respects, return it to where it was 40 or 50 years ago, at least in terms of populism and its economic populism, and it's working for the working class, or frankly, the vast majority of Americans. You can look at somebody made the point I read on Twitter that if you look at DSA, now Graham Platt is not DSA, but policies were in some respects aligned, at least with some of the major planks of DSA. But if you look at like the DSA platform, it is no more radical, and in many instances less radical, frankly, than what we saw during the New Deal. And I'm hoping to interview Robert Kuttner, and that interview will be played over the next week or so. But this is a guy who's been in Democratic politics for 40, 50 years, and many of the policies that were mainstream Democratic, we have just moved so far from those in the Democratic Party, that it feels radical now to have an agenda that is focused on, you know, the 99%, for lack of a better word. But here, let's play this clip because I thought this was really indicative. Remember, Graham Plattner and the politics he represented got 150,000 votes in the Maine primary, a record number of votes in the Democratic primary. And the idea that this was a function of the his, you know, sort of the aesthetic package that he presented as opposed to his policies is a way for the establishment, the corporatists, to diminish what Maine voters were voting for. And here is a perfect example. Play this clip.
Of the kind of jerk he really is. So I was disgusted by it. I know there's reporting that there had been some conversations. I mean, I love when he's talking about the corporate media and, you know, don't come from Washington. Actually, your guy Morse Katz blew up from New York City, and I don't think anybody sees Bernie Sanders as like the corporate, you know, influence of any campaigns. I mean, no responsibility. No, you know, he and his team owe the people of Maine an apology. They will never
pause
get it
for
but
one
they sure
a second. I just want to just point out here, the issue isn't where you live. Right? I mean, like when people say Washington politics, I mean, I always found that sort of like that construct to be absurd. But the issue isn't where you live, right? It's not that like you come from Washington or you come from New York. It is about establishment politics. And here's the thing that people have to understand. When the Tea Party began to challenge and take over the Republican Party, this was not a grassroots movement. This was funded extensively by the Koch brothers. It may have been grassroots when it was actually the Tea Party was, you know, part of Ron Paul's campaign in 2008. But it quickly became a Koch brothers network funded entity. And people forget at that time, the Koch brothers had essentially built I guess you could call a network that was rivaling, if not more powerful than the RNC. They bought all of the voter data files. They basically edged out the RNC. This is the progressives in this instance, relative to the Democratic Party, do not have those same type of resources. It is just because someone comes from New York or their great grandfather was a playboy and now they're writing about is not indicative of what we're talking about when people say Washington politics. They're talking about establishment politics. They're talking about a politics that does not care about people, everyday people. Continue.
But they're bringing up Morris, but it's revealing why they're bringing up Morris, because the consultants that they favor all come from New York and DC, but they're annoyed that the campaign had a rhetorical and ideological difference from the other campaigns they support, where the consultants are coming from DC and Washington. And have you ever seen when Eric Swalwell dropped out because of his accusations of rape, or when you had, you know, other campaigns that ended in disgrace
Andrew
because
Cuomo.
Of personal scandal, Andrew Cuomo, which many of these people were supportive of,
Bill
have you ever heard a focus on the consultants this much? And that's, I think it gives away the game, because this whole class of Democrats is financially threatened and they're resentful of Morris Katz from the Zoran Mamdani campaign onward for doing politics in a different way that doesn't enrich them with all of these media ad buys. And so that is part of the proxy for why they're going after Plattner this hard, is because they are becoming irrelevant and they want to kill Morris in the crib, essentially, and this kind of campaigning.
I want to make something clear. James Carville, the idea that he was not aware of Bill Clinton's past while he was campaigning, I don't know if he was the campaign manager or Stephanopoulos was the campaign manager, but they were the two primary people. Incidentally, a major documentary done about them. And the idea that Carville is not, you know, sort of like looking for publicity is absurd. He has been a mainstay of Democratic politics for 30 years. He is still people are still going him for comments now about what the Democratic Party should do today. Married to Dick Cheney's, one of Dick Cheney's key political operatives. This is a guy who clearly knew what Bill Clinton's past was. And there is not, you never hear a single peep about that. But let's go back to Karen Finney, who incidentally not only worked for Hillary Clinton, but was also worked for John Edwards. And I will tell you, I was supportive of John Edwards. I liked his political message. I didn't know anything about what was going on with John Edwards. But this is not a guy who necessarily showed a tremendous amount of integrity when it came to his relationships with women. But continue.
No, you know, he and his team owe the people of Maine an apology. They will never get it, but they sure deserve it.
I think the voters of Maine actually owe the Democratic primary voters owe the rest of the Mainers an apology. Democrat primary voters knew Graham Plattner was awful the whole time. They knew that he said society should be disrupted if you didn't agree with him. They knew that women incredibly accused him of physical abuse. They knew that, in fact, Graham Plattner said that he had a very flexible moral compass. The badness is why Democrat primary voters picked him, and they're the ones that foisted this problem on us. Don't just blame Graham Plattner. Blame Maine Democrats.
He was before the...
Pause it for a second. But first of all, what is the problem that was foisted upon that guy? Like, what is the problem that was foisted upon that guy? By that, right, I mean... Where is the apology that we're getting from the 100 or 90 some odd million people who voted for? It's just absurd.
Yeah. And I mean, they hate the voters. They're resentful of the voters. They think the voters are hogs that are easily manipulated and led around and hypnotized by Graham Plattner's voice. And they have motivated reasoning behind that because they don't want to look at what resonated about that campaign, which were the issues and wanting to cut taxes raise taxes on billionaires, wanting a Medicare for all style system, wanting to end the genocide in Gaza and cut off arms to Israel. I also think that is some of the motivation around going after Morris as well, because he's an American Jew that was behind Zohran Mamdani's campaign. And there's a Zionist press that is out for any Jewish person right now, Brad Lander included, we'll play that later, who is speaking about the humanity of Palestinians. So, like, there's just a lot of stuff here that isn't about the campaign, including the national narrative about Graham Plattner's personal character or what was overlooked about his past Reddit posts, which is, I think, a fair conversation for people to have, but it wasn't resonating in Maine. Like, we're talking not about electing Graham Plattner as the best American on the planet. We're talking about electing him in a representative democracy in a purple state where he was resonating and riding that momentum because it was the best chance of defeating Susan Collins with a platform that we also supported. So there's these two dueling track conversations about Plattner that seem to not intersect. But the one that's most important is the part about what voters wanted. And I don't understand why people seem to not be foregrounding that at all, because we're talking about politics and electoral politics.
I mean, the bottom line is, if you were to take this scenario and it happened in New York, it would be a very, very different conversation, simply as a function of, like, you know, Maine is not a, you know, the center of the media. And Maine is also like a... I don't know if it's how unique it is in terms of its insular or parochial quality, but that's a nature of Maine politics. I can assure you that the overwhelming number of people who voted in that Maine Democratic primary have absolutely no idea or care, frankly, for that matter, where this show, any show, CNN, whatever it is, where they are on this. And it is quite clear, you know, the New York Times had a story, I think it was today, that the one thing that Maine Democrats seem to be completely unified on, I'm talking in terms of the candidates and the voters, is they want Chuck Schumer and the Democratic establishment to stay out of what's going on. And I know you've touched on it probably briefly. The the mechanism in which they're going to find another candidate is, for the most part, a pretty good one, you know, relative to the sort of like urgency that they find themselves in. It is going to be 600 delegates from across, I think it is, 60 counties in Maine? 16 counties in Maine. And those delegates are going to be elected at meetings that you, if you're a Maine voter, you can go and attend. And actually nominate yourself to be one of the delegates. They're all going to be sent to this convention, and it's going to be, you know, in many respects, a brokered convention, but at least it's going to be transparent. It's going to be a function of people voting in these Democratic parties. And the whole key to this is going to be to keep the 15,000 people volunteered for Plattner engaged. And if you have that level of enthusiasm and the platform of this new candidate is consistent with that of Plattner's campaign, you know, I think there's a reason to believe that it's going to be just as competitive, if not more so, than it was going to be before. And but Maine voters will be deciding that, or at least Maine Democratic voters. That's where we're at. But it's been fascinating from... you lost me there for a second.
Yeah, it's been fascinating from... And then you got cut.
Yeah, out. I got you. Cut. Yeah. Okay. It's been fascinating from the sort of like... I haven't been as engaged in politics as normal, still probably more than you.
We just lost him again. Okay. We can hear you though.
Not on the video. We can't. We can hear you in studio, but we have to refresh him. There we go. Okay. That should work. There you go.
Okay.
Sorry about that, folks. I've got a weak signal here.
South has been Carolina has bad Wi-Fi, huh?
Brian. First of all, do you think I'd still be in state?
Yeah.
Dang it. See how... Shoot.
Dang it.
Sorry. Yep. It has been fascinating to see how... I'm back, yep. Right? It's been fascinating to see how there has been an attempt to extrapolate what happened in Maine to Michigan, to any other progressive race around the country. And that is a deliberate, attempt by the establishment to regain their mojo through any means necessary. And this is what it is. This is what politics is. And this is what it is to be in an interesting fight within the Democratic Party. I mean, frankly, it was Ezra Klein and Derek Thompson who articulated it. I mean, we saw it, that this is an internecine fight within the Democratic Party. We saw it during the Kamala Harris campaign. It's just very often, it's the same thing, like, you know, where people say we shouldn't be pushing a class war. Folks, there has been a class war. It's just that for decades, much of the people losing that war were not even aware it was being waged. And really, for the first time during the Harris campaign, it became really clear to see where those lines were drawn when it came to whether we were going to continue to have antitrust regulation, where we're going to continue to have a movement to disempower money in our politics. And it played out during the Harris campaign, and it's playing out again.
Yep. Yep. And, you know, I will say, because I had forgotten about this too, we also didn't come to our certain conclusions about Plattner, you know, in a vacuum. We did have a viewer who had written into us as well, where she experienced sexual violence and then went to the campaign and had asked him about that. And she had said that she thought that his answer was sufficient to quell some of her fears. So that was part of the evidence that we had in supporting the campaign. Now, there's the separate issue, I think, where people say, well, can you look how can you look over his past Reddit posts where he glorifies violence against Iraqis and also had some racially insensitive remarks about black people as well, where, you know, if that's a deal breaker for you, I understand that. We were compelled by some of his, I think, you know, ability to say, I apologize for that, and I've learned and I've grown. And I do think we have to give people the capacity to do that. And also, Maine voters believed it. So, like, that, you know, I think is relevant here. 100%. And if you think that is an indication of character and that is immutable and unchanging, that is your prerogative, but that's not my worldview. And so that was the context in which he was running. And if there were another candidate in another race that wasn't like one of the whitest states in the country who was also getting this kind of crap, we would be defending them just as vigorously. And so I think there's this assumption that there's a double standard here where, you know, I think that that's something we can examine. We're also looking at electoral politics within demographic contexts and within a very rural white state in Maine. Like, Plattner's views on gun control are not where I'm at, in the same way that Dan Osborne's views on immigration in Nebraska aren't where I'm at. But we're going to fight hard to get him elected because it's important for the state of our democracy.
Yeah. And I will say, you know, look, there's been many candidates over the years that I have supported that have either imploded. I mean, I'm thinking, like, you know, guys like Andrew Gillum down in Florida, John Edwards. I was supportive of his campaign. Frankly, his behavior as a candidate was just the height of irresponsibility and of narcissism. Mm-hmm. Elliot Spitzer, maintain that Elliot Spitzer, had he not, you know, functioned so irresponsibly as governor, completely unaware of, I mean, these are not the same things that have been alleged in terms of Plattner. And it's not the same thing, but in terms of, you know, supposed, I guess, you know, sort of like mistakes in terms of support, Elliot Spitzer still contend would have actually been an amazing president. Edwards, Jim Webb, back when we had the Majority Report on Air America, went very hard for Jim Webb, and he turned out to be not the guy that I had hoped. The John Tester, in some respects, was not as good as I had hoped, but he was okay. There have been many through Fetterman, for that matter.
I was going to say Fetterman.
Although Fetterman took a lot of Israel money, corporate money, too. Like, there's getting a conflation with Plattner, too, where part of why we were more trustful of Plattner was because of the fact that he only took small dollar contributions.
He had better politics.
Politics,
without a doubt.
I don't think are in dispute.
Yeah, I'm not comparing any of these candidates to back from a distance. As a commentator from a distance, make mistakes. Primary voters make mistakes.
Hold on, Sam. Hold on.
All right.
Sam was also a big Roy Moore guy, too. I think that blew up on him,
well,
too.
Well, I mean, and frankly, Al Franken, people still debate whether Al Franken should have been pushed out at that time. I mean, in the context of attempting to fight an establishment that has all the resources, that has all the energy, that has the best reach to low information voters, there are going to be mistakes that are made over the course of these things. And, you know, it happened with the Tea Party, as I said, like your Christine O'Donnells on the way to them essentially taking over the party. So there's going to be some version of that one way or another. And, you know, obviously, I'm glad that Graham Plotner dropped out. You know, to the extent that you can assess these things, the story from Jenny Rasico sounded credible to me. And at the very least, Plotner must have known that it was out there and should have addressed it, earlier. She was supportive of his politics. She was hesitant to bring anything up in the context of the campaign. And I certainly can understand and am aware of the difficulty of someone coming out reporting rapes in real time. I mean, there's nothing, you know, that strikes me about that other than being tragic. This is where we're at. And hopefully Maine Democratic voters will again choose a politics that is against the oligarchy, that is for, you know, material benefits for the vast majority of people. And we'll see. I mean, for the most part, most of the people in the race, you know, to varying degrees are subscribing to similar politics, some more than others. And Maine voters will figure that out. There really isn't time for ads or outside promotion. It's going to be what group of people in Maine are most motivated to go down to those county caucuses and get themselves elected and then become a delegate and then vote for hopefully a progressive candidate. And hopefully those folks, those 15,000 folks who volunteered in Plotner's campaign do not get discouraged and continue to fight for the politics they want.
Yeah. Exactly.
All right. Why don't you choose a clip?
The next clip. Okay.
My internet is so dicey here.
Well, I'll read some IMs and then we'll. I do want to play the Lander thing, so I'll just read a few IMs. Jack said, "This is why we need Lincoln Chafee. He has no scandals." Bob Villain, "I always get so excited to see burly white men run as populist progressives, and I'm feeling like a damn fool right now." Well, we don't need to, you know, make further assumptions about other burly white men, I think, even though, you know.
I mean, I'll just say,
I appreciate that, Emma.
I've been thinking about your talk with the Slate lady. Like, they just wanted a guy. It's like, I think part of it is they're sick of hiring or voting for lawyers.
Yeah. Yeah. Nicola, Sam, at least per the DSA ambition where taking over the Democratic Party is concerned, the intention isn't to make the party like it was 50 years ago. It's to use that structure to build an actual leftist party with the intention of building socialism. It's more ambitious and progressive than making the Dems New Deal again.
I'm not speaking for the DSA, but I'm talking about in terms of the actual platforms that we see. You know, I'm out at a place where they have, and Brian, I know you've been here, but they have in addition to their buses, they have a free Uber style service that is paid for by the fees that are collected in this area. And I'm like, what? We're talking about making buses free in New York City as if it's like some type of a Bolshevik revolution, and they got free door-to-door car stuff here. Yeah. Like, are you kidding me? Paid for by the city? I mean, that my point's not what the DSA's agenda is as a party or an institution or an organization. My point is in terms of like the policy positions that are espoused at the moment, particularly with the candidates are running for federal office. These are not radical proposals in the context of the history of the United States. I mean, in New York State, in California, 40 years ago, you could basically go to college for free, if not totally free, before then. We had FDR's policies of the WPA, of bailing out homeowners. I mean, on and on and on. This stuff is in today's parlance is considered completely wildly fantastical. We had a 90% tax on the top marginal rate in the 50s and 60s. Nobody is proposing that outside of myself. And I'm not a candidate, but I'm saying there's no candidates who are proposing that. I mean, so the politics that we're talking about are not radical in the context of the history of the United States. They're radical in the context of what the corporate media and what we've been sort of like trained to believe.
We had a Heather Cox Richardson clip. I don't know. Did we play that clip?
No, because I didn't love her framing, but it is interesting how she still got to the fact that DSA is not that radical.
Yeah, she suggested that Mom Downey would be to the right of Republicans in 1936.
That's why we didn't play it. But I have on this front here. This is the water park in my hometown of Manan, North Dakota, Raging Rivers. Emma, you might have seen this when you were going through there.
Maybe.
And when I was leaving for college, it went bankrupt, and I'm like, oh no, that was so fun because I got a nice big water slides, lazy river and stuff like that. And guess who's owned it since 2009, and it's been thriving? The Mandan Park Board. They just bought it. Yeah. And like people don't even think about it. And people that use this every single summer and then question me about Zora Mamdani doing a city grocery store. It's like the main attraction to our city in the summer is owned by the city.
Yeah.
Anyway.
That's amazing.
Is there a wave pool?
There is. I think that is a wave pool. It's been so long since I've been
down
there.
That's a big deal.
I think there is a wave pool over there. There used to be, there's go-karts and stuff like that. You can see in the top left there. It's a great experience.
I kind of like water parks. It's such an American experience. I know everyone's peeing in there, but I still can't help it. I know Brian's like,
no way.
I think there's no way Brian would get in that water too much. It's your worst nightmare. All right, let's do this though before we, you know, lose you.
Can I just also say in terms of Heather Cox, 1936, the Republican Party came out and called Social Security socialism. I mean,
it was weird framing.
The most prominent historian. Maybe she was just being hyper.
She was framing it just around the fact that none of the Republicans at the time were trying to change the income tax. That 92% income. It was specific to that.
I'll take the point that today's Republicans are like cretinous, like
scum,
arsonists of civilization.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But let's do this because Brad Lander went on CNN and spoke with Dana Bash a few days ago. And, you know, what's interesting is that Brad, who is going to be my next representative, and I, you know, campaigned for him. I believed in him unseating Dan Goldman. He's not where I am on the issue of Israel-Palestine. He describes himself in this interview as a liberal Zionist. And, you know, there are contradictions in what he says here. One is that, and I just want people to look out for it before we play it, that Israel can be both Jewish and democratic. It cannot be that, because that would still maintain a Jewish supremacy that has led to the genocide and ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. And there are millions of Palestinians in the West Bank. Yeah, there were, 2 million Palestinians in Gaza who would change the demographics. And that's why they're trying to force them out for a full state. Israel controls the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem. And those Palestinians would have to be full citizens, which would not make Israel Jewish, but it would make it democratic. So that is a contradiction that, you know, if we were dealing in facts, Dana Bash would push back on Brad Lander and say, how is that possible? But that's not where she goes. She's legitimately upset that he doesn't describe himself as just a Zionist, that he describes himself as a liberal Zionist. This was astonishing.
One of the big reasons you won your primary here is that you separated yourself from the incumbent Democrat Dan Goldman on Israel. You use the term genocide. He does not. You don't want to have the U.S. funding Israel militarily. You call yourself a liberal Zionist. What is a liberal Zionist?
I believe in the vision of a Jewish and democratic Israel. I care about the place, but I don't think it's possible for it to be democratic while it's occupying the West Bank and Gaza. And I don't think that Israel's conduct in Gaza, which I do consider a genocide, is consistent with Jewish values. So to me, it's like you stand up and you call it as you see it. I don't want to keep sending U.S. military aid to Israel while it's violating international law and Palestinian human rights. But I want it to actually honor international law and Palestinian human rights so it can be the Jewish and democratic Israel that I grew up believing in.
I'm sorry. I just want to make sure I understand. You said that you don't think it's a democratic Israel?
I want it to be a Jewish and democratic Israel. Right now, I don't think it's modeling democracy while it occupies the West Bank and Gaza and half the people under its sovereignty can't vote. But I believe that when occupation ends, then it can be Jewish and democratic. And that's what I am going to be I'm fighting for.
Why are you not just a Zionist? Why do you say liberal Zionist? What do you think the difference is?
I mean, the Declaration of Independence that founded Israel says it would be a place for the ingathering of exiles and full civil and political rights for everyone living there. But Palestinians living in the West Bank facing settler terrorism or living in refugee camps in Gaza because their schools and hospitals were destroyed, they don't have full political and civil rights. So it is not living up to its founding vision. And to me, believing in Jewish and democratic means you got to fight for the human rights of Palestinians at the same time as you fight for the safety of Jews. I guess maybe a shorthand way of saying it is, I don't think Israelis will be safe until Palestinians are free, and they both need that.
Can I just ask you point blank? Do you not call yourself a Zionist because it is a term that many people on the hard left have started to use as a slur against Jews?
Oh, well, my God.
I mean, a liberal Zionist is a Zionist.
She uses the term. He's just like to say
this
liberal.
This is liberal in front of it. Wait, is that the end of it? Or just twenty more seconds. Hold on.
Oh yeah, no, we've got it. This is psychotic. This is somebody,
I know.
This is Dana Bash having a literally like a nervous breakdown on television.
She's calling him a bad Jew in her head the entire time.
It's like she forgets she's on camera. She's like, why don't you though?
Like, look at her face.
Squirming.
She actually genuinely seemingly can't comprehend what she's hearing. This man who's just talking about Palestinians as human beings.
Should add that while this interview is taking place, I don't know if it exactly lines up, but CNN reporters in a car in the West Bank with Jasper Nathaniel, actually, who I know you're going to have on
Wednesday,
are being attacked by Jewish settlers in the West Bank. And they are doing so under the auspices and the watchful eye of the Israeli military. It's just a bizarre sort of line of questions. Go ahead, continue.
I don't think Israelis will be safe until Palestinians are free, and they both need that.
Can I just ask you point blank? Do you not call yourself a Zionist because it is a term that many people on the hard left have started to use as a slur against Jews?
Well, no, I mean, a liberal Zionist is a Zionist. I just want to make clear I'm not a Zionist like Ben-Gvir or Smotrich who want to eliminate Palestinians. So that's why
I
say
it. You can be an American and not believe in what Donald Trump believes in.
To me, that's what I am here. I believe
a liberal American.
American isn't
Israel, but it's got to change if it's going to be that.
Also, I will tell you, there are Israelis who are not Zionists. There are people who have been born in Israel who reject Israel as a Jewish state. Jews, in fact, I think probably like my first understanding of the Nakba came from an Israeli who rejected the Zionist project. And years and years ago before I did this. I mean, so her, this is baby brain stuff. I mean, like, it's sort of, if you want to make the case that many American Jews have been effectively brainwashed, you would take this interview as a primary case of Dana Bash, who is a host on CNN, who's a news person, who has ostensibly been reading into this and understands the nuance of things, is completely befuddled by what is an incredibly mainstream position in this country. If anything, to the right of the mainstream position of American Jews.
I just want to make the point real quick. Like, John Kerry on his way out as Secretary of State, which I'm pretty sure Dana Bash was in the press at this time, said Israel can either be Jewish or it could be Democratic. It cannot be both. He explicitly said that. Like, we just decide we don't have to remember things that were in our frontal lobe at some point. It's crazy.
It really is. And this is just a quick clip to underscore a little bit what's going on at CNN here, because no doubt Dana Bash is a Zionist fundamentalist and a zealot. But this is how Jake Tapper and Trump's interview ended yesterday. And Tapper and Dana Bash are auditioning for the Ellisons and have been for some time, letting their freak flag fly, as it were, and just editorializing constantly and putting forward their Zionist belief system. This is how this interview ended. And put this in the context of Jake Tapper, basically, you know, yelling at everybody and talking about how Graham Platner and supporting him was awful and how the CNN is framing it, where Trump has been accused of sexual assault many, many times by dozens of women, including found liable in court for sexual battery of E. Jean Carroll, and Jake Tapper is, like, sucking up to him like this.
Well, I know you don't want to talk about any other issues out of respect for Lindsey Graham, but we would love to have you back sometime, because I do have a lot of other questions for you, sir.
Sure. We'll do that. We'll do that.
Thank you for calling in.
We're trying to have CNN go in a normal path, and we'll do that.
Well, I'm on a normal path right here, sir, and I appreciate your time, and thank you for calling in.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much. We'll be right back after this quick break.
You and I don't even address each other with that level of...
I know. I know.
Of ass kissing. And I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah. But I think that's what Dana Bash is doing to a degree, where it's like, you know, this is the direction they think the network is going, and they're trying to jockey for position. And, like, I'm not saying she doesn't earnestly believe it, but she's giving herself immense license to essentially call Brad Lander a bad Jew on television.
It's shocking. And the conflation of, again, of Zionism and Judaism at this stage is just it's obscene. It's obscene, frankly. And if there was a functioning and legitimate anti-defamation league, they would take moments before they issued a press release saying how disgusting Dana Bash's line of questioning was. I mean, yep. I take it as anti-Semitic, frankly. And it's shocking. It really is shocking. Yeah. What else should we get on here?
Do you want to do your Jaylen Brown thing in case we don't get to it?
Yeah, we should do this.
I can intro, you know, Sam. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. We do that. I mean, I know you've talked obviously about Lindsey Graham.
Oh yes. Unless you want
untimely death. No. No. I will say this, Joe. Just on before on the Lindsey Graham thing, because I get limited time here. But what's interesting is, and I cannot remember the name of the woman who is running against him, but the most recent polling showed that she was in within 5 points of Lindsey Graham. And I don't think that that it was likely that you were going to have a Democrat win this seat in the fall against Lindsey Graham. But Donald Trump has called for the installation of Lindsey Graham's sister to hold the seat. Her term would run until January 20th, more or less, 2027.
Okay, we lost Sam again.
Oh, I'm back.
All right, come on.
Can you, hear me? Sorry. Yeah. Sorry, folks. I know how frustrating this is. If it makes you feel better, I'm very frustrated by it, too.
Guys, it keeps happening. I know. All right. Something's going on.
Now it should be back.
All right.
Sorry, folks. Someone's going to run in this primary. And now South Carolina, they've got to do a primary relatively quick. It may be Lindsey Graham's sister. It may not be who's actually going to run. But somebody's got to run. And that election, once that election happens, that person's only going to sit in that seat for, you know, a couple of months later. So South Carolina, it's a long shot, but the Republicans are going to have to spend a lot more money there than they thought they were just, you know, a week ago. And so that's going to be helpful. And also, you know, Lindsey Graham, horrible person.
Yep.
In a multitude of ways. Somehow, you know, the narrative is worst thing that he did is he ultimately bent the knee to Donald Trump. He was also very responsible for, just this guy was a house manager for Bill Clinton's impeachment. And the rife hypocrisy involved in all that was astonishing. And I would love to crack open Lindsey Graham's, love to get a hold of Lindsey Graham's diary and see the,
Israel already has it. Don't worry.
Yeah, I bet. All right, let's go into this, Jaylen Brown. Last week too was, Jaylen Brown was traded and
I'm sorry. Pretty
nothing,
pretty poor return.
Insane.
Oh, he was given nothing. I mean, the only argument is that somehow, like, it's going to free up some cash and sort of like allow the team to get a more distinct personality, I guess. But Jaylen Brown
save some money
was
for the private equity ownership too, which you know, don't scoff at that.
Right? Isn't that what Celtics fans care about?
He's such a good guy.
I know. Well, that's the thing is now, unfortunately, he's on Philly. I wish he was out of, like, you know, the East. But he is so easy to root for. One, because Jaylen Brown is one of the few athletes that has really stood up for the Palestinian people and, like, showed up with, you know, Gaza bracelets to make a point at parts during the genocide, the ongoing genocide. But he's also just a champion for players' rights. So he sat down here on the $1 million worth of game podcast. There's so many podcasts that are all exactly like this, but for athletes. But here is, or maybe this isn't an athletic show or athlete show, I'm not sure, but whatever. Here he is talking about why he chose to use the NBA Players Association instead of hiring an agent for the draft, and he makes a great case here for labor rights.
When I entered the draft, no, I didn't have an agent. I'm probably the highest pick selected ever that didn't enter with an agent.
Why you ain't have an agent?
Just when I was evaluating, I went through the whole process and sat with a bunch of people and what they was offering, I didn't really need for real. And you know, it was kind of already slotted. So I leaned on the union a lot more. And then, a lot of the agents came and was like, yeah, we're gonna move you to LA. We'll get you a trainer, put some money in your pocket, da 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 da. And I was like, for what? You know? And it was like, Do I got to get that money back? They were like, nah, but, you know, standard agent fee is 4%. So I'm starting to do the math, and a house, car, and all that, whatever you was offering is a lot less than what 4% would have been. So long story short, you know, the math wasn't mathing for me. But I ended up being the third pick, even though I took some, you know, I think because I came in like that, a lot of people tried to, well, some of the think it was the agents, they tried to like slander my name a little bit, put it in the media that he's too this, he's too that. Ended up backfiring. But you know, it all worked out in the end.
What game did the union give you to have you like, all right, I can do this?
With a union.
Without the agent.
Yeah, with a union, we pay dues. All the players in the NBA pay dues. We all pay like $10,000 or something like that out of our salary. That goes to hiring lawyers, hiring, you know, just staff, CEO, see everything that you need to lead a company, just that works for us. So all of that is our resources that we all pay for, that we agree to. So once I learned that, I just started using it.
If anybody have any issues in the NBA, they can just go to the players union. They handle anything for you.
For sure. Security. I'm talking about you can get, you know, private investigations done. They get, you know, they give referrals for financial advisors. They have a list of approved.
You get a trust done, all type of stuff.
All type of stuff, yeah. Foundation-wise, health insurance, whatever you need. They have a liaison that's paid to make sure that you get it done.
Yeah.
So I put it on their desk, like, I need you to get this done. And they do.
Yeah, and another point in the interview, he talks about how players should have equity in the way that CEOs do when they're building up companies. But it's really interesting there because, like, he asked that question where he says it's slotted. Like in a lot of drafts, it's where you're selected that determines your salary, and your rookie contract is essentially, there's no, because of the way that the CBA or the collective bargaining is negotiated, like those are slotted, and he'll have that contract for his rookie year, basically. So he's asking the question, why would I need an agent to take 4% of this when I could just have the union represent me here when my contract is already basically set? And then he touts unions there. And when he talks about how the agents were slandering his name in the draft in retaliation, that is a thing. That's a thing across sports where agents are upset when players go and don't hire them. But it's also a thing for teams. It's a dirty business where they want a player to fall to them. So they'll leak negative things about them in the press, harming the players and making them fall and losing money in the draft as they go further down. Josh Allen. There are a bunch of other ones. But anyway, Sam, your thoughts?
No, I mean, that is so helpful for the union movement, I think, in a way that, like, you know, where he is expressing the fact that when workers get together and they pay into a union, the union is there to represent them. And I mean, aside from all the other great things about Jaylen Brown that, you know, just in terms of the work he's done in the community and how intelligent he is, this is very helpful for, I honestly would love the ability to, a year or two down the road, look at people who have joined unions when that debate comes up in their car factory or their warehouse or the service industry. And people say, you know, I would love the ability to study in the future. How many of them got a perspective on the union that they never heard about from Jaylen Brown? Really helpful. I mean, to the extent that I'm actually thinking about buying, you know, I go see the Celtics with Saul when they play the Nets every year. I'm actually thinking about watching the Sixers Nets. Yeah, I know. It's sad, but I'm actually going to do it.
Yeah,
I'm
great.
Actually going to do it. All right, I got time for one more clip.
Okay, you do? What should we get to here?
Another Cory Booker?
Oh, yes. So, Sam, who says bipartisanship is dead? You know, there are some things that we can all agree on here. Yep. And by all, I mean anybody that's taken a bunch of Israel money.
And the Dan, a little inspiring clip of comedy.
Yes.
Nice to see somebody reach across the closet.
Listen, it's important. It is important. It is important that folks in Washington reach their fist across the aisle and fight.
That's what they talk about with double
I want
fisting.
That Michigan fist.
Okay. partners together, Lindsey Graham in this and Cory Booker here. So he has a social media video where he talks about his dear friend, Lindsey.
So I go up to Lindsey Graham, and I'm a brand new senator, determined to do something about mass incarceration. And I hear through Dick Durbin and others that he's the guy to work with. And I say, Mr. Graham, sir, I'd like to work with you on criminal justice reform. He seems almost amused by what I said. He goes, Corey, do you understand? I'm in a primary right now, and I'm running against a guy who is batshit crazy. I can't even so much as talk to you right now. Get out of here, man. Come back to me after my primary. And I laughed and came back to him after the primary. And true to his word, he rolled up his sleeves and we went to work. And thanks to him and Dick Durbin and some other Senate heroes, our bill became the First Step Act after years, two presidents, two Congresses, and became law. One of my favorite moments in that negotiation was at the last minute, I'm trying to force one more thing into that bill. This has to do with children being put in solitary confinement. And I am going at it with this White House official who says, no, hard no. And we're almost yelling at each other. And then he says, I'm going to get Lindsey Graham on the phone and he will tell you. And so he gets the White House operator to connect Lindsey Graham onto the phone. And Lindsey Graham listens for maybe a hot second and then interrupts the guy and says, are you kidding me? We need Cory Booker to get this bill done. We can't do it without him. Give him what he wants. And it was in the bill. It's now part of the law of the land. One of the White House negotiators during that first negotiation told me that Lindsey Graham was like an unguided missile. That God, he never knew which way he was going to go, whether he would come back and hit you.
I'm not sure unguided missile is exactly the language you want to...
Not the land on you or a girl's school.
Yeah.
I have no idea where that missile's
in Iran.
No, you guys, in Cory Booker's parlance, that's a positive. he loves unguided missiles almost as much as Lindsey Graham did.
That story was all a brag, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. We need Cory on this. We need him.
I honestly, you have to be very, very out of touch, I think, to think this is helpful in any way. First off, you're showing how sort of like nakedly the idea that somehow, you know, Graham should get plaudits because he's not in favor of putting children into solitary confinement is just like, and
he's just in favor of slaughtering them in Palestine. And Cory Booker's like on his soapbox about his protecting of children, where he's doing the same thing.
There's no assessment of like he is willing, you know, like he was such a man of integrity that he was absolutely not going to bring up an important issue during the primary for fear of alienating. And also it's also a huge tell as to like how 180 he did on Trump. I mean, the man had no principles beyond a bloodlust for bombing in the Middle East. I mean, that was, you know, and we have all this John McCain hagiography, asked and because he was against Trump, and McCain himself was also sort of bloodthirsty, and he made Lindsey Graham made John McCain seem reasonable and full of integrity. I mean, it's amazing.
This is how that video ends. Cory Booker says he hopes Lindsey's in heaven with his friend John McCain. That's literally how this
wait goes. Okay, so we have to play the rest of it.
Okay.
But when he was aligned, when he would be in the right place at the right time, man, he could get things done that other people couldn't and bring a lot of
senator
light and new possibilities to the efforts. I am stunned at Lindsey Graham's death, but I pray that he is reunited with his friend, John McCain, that they both are experiencing God's love, grace, mercy, and forgiveness. My prayers are with his family and all those who loved and cherished him. I will miss my perhaps most unexpected friend in the Senate and someone with whom I got some good things done.
Oy. Also, the friendship
we gotta
with
abolish
John McCain
the Senate.
Yeah.
I've been saying that.
Yeah.
But we got some time before.
What'd you say?
I don't know what else to, you know, yeah. We have some time before we get to the abolishment of the Senate. But it is like, I'm sorry. How can you talk about threats to democracy? How can you talk about what ICE is doing? How can you talk about any of these things? And, you know, if you have personally warm feelings for the guy, okay, great. And if you have some good stories to tell at the local, you know, in the Senate lounge, all right, good. But the fact of the matter is that part of their job as senators is to message things and to indicate to the American public who don't want to spend every moment of their day combing through politics, is to indicate, like, you know, what's good, what's bad, you know, what direction we should be heading in. And Lindsey Graham projected to the American public, you know, not only should we be bombing, I mean, the things he said on national television were just horrific. Yeah. About, you know, bombing Gaza and blowing Iran off the face of the earth and all of this stuff. He was one of the big proponents of getting us into Iraq and Afghanistan and teaching the American public that pulling out of a war is a bad thing. And on and on and on and on. And when Cory Booker goes out there and validates this guy's life after that, even if he thinks it personally, he's also doing damage to the American society because he is validating it. And it's incomprehensible to me that these people don't understand what role they have in American politics. I'm sorry. You don't have to say anything. You don't have to go out there and shit on him. I understand that as a senator, but show your respect.
Although he would have loved that.
Your mouth shut.
Sorry.
As a guy who is focusing so much of my effort on ending human suffering on the planet Earth.
Two bangers for Brian to bookmark this segment. Incredible.
All right. Well, look, I've got to jump off. I'm hopefully going to be recording some stuff that you guys will have for the next couple of days. There's a chance I may be able to hop on Wednesday. Oh, I froze again.
We can hear you.
We can hear you.
You're good.
Okay. I might be able to hop on Wednesday. I'm very keen to hear of Jasper's experience in the West Bank. And I've got to try and figure out my Wi-Fi situation, hopefully a little better going forward. But it's going to be another couple of weeks for me, folks. But you're in good
Kentucky.
Hands. Well, I got a list. I got a list.
You're dressed like Jaylen Brown in that video.
These things don't happen overnight.
All right.
All right, folks. I leave you. I'll talk to you later.
All right. Read some IMs, and then I wanted to quickly touch on the Michigan race, if we have the ability to quickly do that. 11 and... Wait, 12. No, actually, I wanted... Do we have the APAC ad that I sent in Slack? Oh, yeah, 10. 10. Maybe it's not APAC, but it's an outside group. Maybe we could look up where this ad is from. It's 10.
I know where to find it.
Okay.
Who it is.
Okay, yeah, cool. I'll just read some items really quickly. Spaghetti Brains, I'm opposed to feeding children into my very hungry wood chipper. I'd like a standing ovation now, please.
I mean, that's the other thing. I'm sorry. Like, look, not against... occasional bipartisan legislation do good thing. Look at the scoreboard, Corey.
I know.
Like,
I know.
Not only on just a general like fascist decline we're in terms of mass incarceration, you still think people are in the mood to take a victory lap route that we're still the number one jailer of on Earth right now.
And he won't even oppose ICE. So
yeah.
Okay.
The ad is a committee for a stronger Michigan. I'm just trying to figure out.
All right. Well. Actually, let's just do that tomorrow. Then we'll do that tomorrow. But I want to just quickly play 12. So I saw this clip over the weekend. This reporter Sam Robinson has been interviewing voters in Michigan. Early voting has started in Michigan ahead of that incredibly important primary between Haley Stevens and Abdullah Syed. And this man, his name is Ahmed Al-Rayashi, spoke to Sam Robinson, the reporter, about why he's voting for Abdullah Syed. He says that he voted in 2024 for Trump because he was so outraged over the war in Gaza. He's a Chrysler employee and a UAW member. And this is his explanation as to why Abdullah Syed has his vote.
All right, what's your name?
Ahmed Al-Rayashi.
Ahmed, what do you like about Abdul? You told me that you voted for Trump in 2024. We got Abdul supporters right here in Chandler Park. What separates him from other Democrats for you?
Well, one, for the Trump one, I'm not saying I'm proud of it, but there was reasons behind it, right, with the Kamala's election, with what she said, you know, with Biden about she's not going to do nothing differently. As far as what separates Abdul from the rest of the Democrats, I would say, one, he's energetic. I believe that the message that he's given is sincere. We've seen what he did, like working for Wayne County, working for Detroit and stuff, what he did for the people and everything. And I'm sick and tired of these, your typical politicians, right? He's running against Haley Stevens. And to me, she's a corporate politician. It's all about the PACs, right? And I was born and raised here. My great grandmother was born and raised here. And what I care about first and foremost is my family, American, right? So it's like, sadly, I'm not a Republican saying this when they say American first, but I feel like Abdul is an American first candidate. He's a Democrat, but an American first candidate. You don't have to be Republican to be American first, because even though Republicans do say that they're American first, they're showing that they're not, right? But I've known people that know Abdul, that know him personally, that he's helped, that it's not out there on the news or whatever, just people from the community, local and stuff. And I've come to realize that what he's saying is sincere based on the message that I'm hearing from other people, regular citizens and stuff, that be like, oh, you know, Abdul helped my family on this when I didn't know what to do and everything, right? Medicare for all. So I work for Chrysler. I'm in the UAW, and we have, I believe, as they say, the best health care in the country, right? And I'm still for Medicare for all, because everybody, like, you know, why try to give free handouts or the other way around? They'll be like, man, you got the best health care. What do you care? I care about humans, right? And when I say stuff like this and I listen to what he says, I feel that connection. I feel like he feels and says the same thing. So this is why I'll support him.
There's just so much there that's important to parse. One, that, like, this is a very good representation of many undecided voters in this country who were swayed by Trump promising change. And the America First thing, it is so important that Democrats hit on this. And Abdul Al-Sayed is doing this expertly in Michigan. We don't want money for foreign wars. We want it here at home. Republicans try to make that case in a less convincing manner, no foreign wars, but they don't have anything to invest in people here at home. Do you see how Abdul Al-Sayed's campaign makes the connection to Medicare for all and for health care? Now, he's a union member. There are some members and cynical members of the Democratic Party who try to divide the working class on this front because unions can provide health care for people, to say that the Medicare for all is an anti-union proposal. You'll hear that. That voter goes, well, I want health care for everybody. I've got great insurance through the UAW, and look at how Abdul Al-Sayed has helped people. That's another key part of this race, because you talk to other voters. There were other interviews over the weekend. I believe it was a woman who had said that, you know, these kids got glasses in my community because Abdul Al-Sayed's advocacy in the community. And then the other part where he says corporate politician, that's about the past. This is also where Democrats need to orient themselves as future and forward-looking candidates, and promising people not to restore something, which is essentially what the entirety of Democratic messaging has been since Trump came into power. We're going to bring you back to the time before Trump, as if people are still nostalgic for it at that point. Abdullah Sayed showing that he's a future-focused candidate and demonstrating that by not taking corporate money. Like, that voter, you'll hear people sneer at them and say, like, how could you vote for Trump over Kamala Harris because of the war in Gaza? I mean, that's on her for not making a distinction about the genocide.
You're told the only way to change things in this country is with your vote, and then you're told, oh, that genocide that's happening is not something that is addressable by your vote. This clip from Kamala in the campaign, this is... She pissed away any chance she had the election with this.
Yeah.
Here's her asking what she would do differently than Joe Biden. And I forgot how bad the way she answered this is.
I was going to say, jump scare.
Well, if anything, would you have done something differently than President Biden during the past 4 years?
There is not a thing that comes to mind in terms of, and I've been a part of most of the decisions that have had impact.
Well, is politics 101? Be the change candidate. I mean, even it, like, but she didn't want to throw old Joe under the bus, and they
So, I, you know, even if you did intend to be a pushover in office with regards to Israel, you could have just lied there and got the voters on your side, because the voters were one way. But why don't you lie? Why doesn't the politician even lie to win? It's because there's another powerful base of support that they're relying on, i.e. the donors, who would have been really upset by that and didn't want her to have any daylight between her and Joe Biden.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly right.
Keeping the same team didn't help either.
No, and they didn't. I mean, she didn't have she didn't have it there. But it's also like, you know, they don't want to be one. They're responsive to donors there, and then two, she didn't want to be hamstrung by any change in future, and to have the flexibility to determine what Israel policy would be as president. And then you don't really have to promise anything to voters. But it turns out people actually cared about this issue and wanted a promise for a shift in policy. And so, like, I'm reminded of the Zoran Mamdani campaign when it started out, when he went and interviewed Trump voters about why they voted for him. And you had people in AOC's district that voted both for her and for Trump. You might think that's crazy, but people's economic circumstances and what appeared to be the Democrats' priorities, which was slaughtering children instead of making the economy better, that's what was sold. That's going to resonate. And Zoran, in the end, won one in every 10 Trump voters in his election. And you have to ask why that is. And I think Abdullah Sayed is tapping into a very similar energy. So
a good time to show up for him if you're out in Michigan with the Peters endorsement going to Stevens. Also, Obama is telling reporters like Dave Weigel that he is not endorsed in that race. We'll probably talk more about that tomorrow.
Good, because we'll talk about more tomorrow. They are running an ad that implies heavily that Obama has endorsed Haley Stevens, because right now the big battle is over Detroit and over the black vote. That's where it seems like both races think that the race is going to be determined.
I wake up and I see Haley Stevens in my dreams.
So she's missed the forces are running ads that are misleadingly showing Obama praising her and I think endorsing her in a different race from the past to make it look like that was what was happening now. Right. And then we also showed the mailers or the different graphics that were being shown where Abdullah Sayed is emphasizing that she voted to memorialize Charlie Kirk, who was a vicious anti-black racist. And she's pushing Kamala Harris appears once again. The Abdullah Sayed had a criticism of Kamala Harris's campaign, but like he endorsed her. So that's the other part.
Actually, a few days before.
Right.
What's her name?
Yeah.
Also, who endorsed Haley Stevens endorsed Mike Bloomberg in 2020.
Which is the most hilarious one that she could possibly do, in keeping with her just, you know, making the funniest choice seemingly every time.
She's an eccentric.
She is.
I mean, that's a lunatic thing to do.
Yeah. All right, guys, gonna read some IMs and get out of here. Luke from Oregon says Grindr lowering their flag for Lady Graham is pretty funny. I didn't see that. Did they do that?
I don't know. I didn't know Grindr had a flag.
Me neither. Maybe some graphic on. Yeah, you don't know? You didn't see this morning that Grindr had lowered the flag on the app?
The flag is on the app?
I would guess that's what they're talking about. I do really want us to have the Grindr sound effect sometimes. See, that's the biggest sadness, is that we didn't get the Grindr sound drop to play on Lindsey Graham clips, and we won't have, we won't be able to do that.
We've got Mike Johnson.
We got Mike Johnson. Yeah. Do you have it? Yeah.
Do the that was it. Right
oh, that now. Was it. Yeah. Yeah. We should play that on certain people's clips.
For our people who know what the grinder sound effect.
Well,
I think we have a decent amount of people who probably do. Hopefully, so we do.
It's still a little bit narrow casting.
If we don't, why would I be upset? There are not enough gay guys in our audience.
Not one listener recognizes
or bi guys. Yeah. More, thank you. More adventurous. A local radio host was talking about how much milder the winters are here in Wisconsin. For some reason, got me thinking about what it might be like to go someplace much different than where I've lived in my life. I couldn't even manage a move to Wisconsin, though. Madison, though. Okay. Civil Result Maps Dev says, do they not understand that the people that elected them don't want them telling us how good people the destroying democracy were good friends? Yeah.
They're still in, like, 1990s politics where they think... I mean, it's the same thing when I saw Obama on Tyrese Halliburton's thing saying, like, look, it wasn't everything we wanted, but there's a lady that's getting prescription drugs down the street. You don't see that.
Yeah.
It's like, there's a crisis going on in this country, materially and civically. So your little bullshit you did 8 years ago now, no one gives a fuck that you crossed the finish line with that. It wasn't enough.
Truly flops. Sam, it's Carville, not Carvel. He's not selling Fudgy the Whale or Cookie Puss.
Yeah. I got so hungry when he said Carvel.
Every time he does it, I know. I don't have the heart to correct him. You got to pick your battles sometimes with his pronunciations.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's you only pick the ones of people we respect.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Devoid Reality, Dan the Bash is starting to morph into Deborah Miro from Andor. I don't know the reference. Real Chuck Schumer. I'll be putting forth an official condemnation of radical leftist Hassan Piker, whose dangerous lovemaking has left one of my colleagues in the hospital and another in the grave. I hope the MR will be condemning this dangerous individual. Sam from Ottawa. I read the Graham news while standing at the start line of a 5K. So my partner had to tell me to calm down as I celebrated a man's death in the crowd of strangers. It helped me set a new personal record, though. There you go.
Oh, nice.
Motivation. Bob Villain. I'm always get so excited to see burly white men running. Oh, I already read that one. Sammy from YS says, it's shocking to me that y'all are even feeling the need to defend your support of Platner. He had a vile act and is now a pariah. We all talk all the time of not letting perfect be the enemy of the good as leftists, and it's strange people can't see why past politics and statements are something people are willing to overlook when voting in their best interests. Yeah, I think it's just, you know, that, like, also, DSA had been having an incredible run, and there were a lot of people that were stewing. I'm not saying these some of the people that are criticizing us maybe on the left were, but there were a lot of Democrats that were furious, and they're using this as an opportunity to try to weaken the left. Social media says Sam's technical issues are analogous to the progressive working class struggle. There will be setbacks. There will be failures. Much of it is out of our control. But nonetheless, we power through. All right, three more. Graham Page, Emma, Sam, please don't say psychotic. You also missed last week that using that word is ableist. Ranella participated in my first general meeting with Portland DSA yesterday. That's amazing. And the final IM of the day. Carolina Commie, many will say the NBA union isn't actually good. It's selfish because stadium workers are still making minimum wage. Obviously, this is a capitalist propaganda akin to the cookie cartoon. But the big salaries break people's brains. Maybe you could explain it for folks and also let us know to what extent the players union is leveraging their power for NBA workers down the totem pole. Well, okay, NBA players have a very short time to capitalize on their physical labor. So they have contracts that are proportionate also to the amount of money that they bring in. Veteran minimums are not that lucrative, and you could be out of the league, and many, many players are out of the league. Rookie contracts too. very soon.
They have no experience in any other thing.
Right.
I mean, you have to be 100% basketball.
You're making your wages in like 10 years of your life if you're lucky. So
and if you don't get media when you get out,
right,
what are
right.
you going to do?
Players are using their physical labor and making a wage. It can be a very high wage, but they don't own the means of production and they aren't invested in their own teams. And that's what Jalen Brown has been calling out to.
And the value of these teams has skyrocketed like fourfold yes. in the past like 20 years. And all of that value is going straight to like in the Phoenix Suns case, the owner that got in trouble, was it for racism or something like that?
Yeah.
Had to sell the team. And guess who got to pocket that? He did, and his kid.
Same yeah. with the Clippers guy, Don Sterling.
Right, right.
Yeah. He made $2 billion off of.
We need to move to cooperative ownership of all sports franchises.
But did that person say concessions?
I think they're saying, if you could explain.
That's not even an NBA employee.
Exactly.
They work for the arena.
Yep. Good point. All right, guys. Appreciate you all. Thank you so, so much. We will see you tomorrow. It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm going to get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught. Seeing the truth in the light bulb, but finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I get somewhere the choice is made. The option where you don't get paid for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I get somehow lost my drive.